Simon & Schuster Audio presents Foreign Agent by Brad Thor. Read by Armin Schultz.
When bad men combine, the good must associate, else they will fall, one by one, an unpitied sacrifice in a contemptible struggle. Edmund Burke. Chapter 1. Friday. CIA Safe House. Al-Anbar Province, Iraq. At 6'4", 275 pounds, Ken Berglund was a massive sight to behold. He had a thick blonde beard and sleeves of tattoos up both arms.
"T-bones are almost ready," he called out.
A cheer arose from his teammates in the courtyard and from the women who had gathered around the old stone slab being used as a dining table. Someone fired up a Charlie Daniels song on their iPhone as more beers were pulled from the cooler. It was a perfect night for a cookout. Above the abandoned desert fortress, the stars shone in the blue-black sky. A cool breeze blew away the lingering heat of the day, and for a moment, you could almost forget where you were. That was until you noticed the modified M4 rifles kept within arm's reach, or the 45 caliber pistols the men carried at their hips. As soon as you saw those, the illusion was shattered. Nobody gunned up that heavy for dinner unless they were in a war zone, which was exactly where they were. Ashley Foster, though, had downplayed the danger when she spun the trip to her two girlfriends as something out of Lawrence of Arabia, a weekend at a romantic desert castle surrounded by nothing but sand and the occasional camel. Of course, as a CIA collection management officer, she knew better. Stationed at the U.S. Embassy in Amman, Jordan, she saw the intelligence on a daily basis. In fact, it was her job to sort it, encrypt it, and send it all back to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. No place in Iraq was safe, and that went double for Anbar. ISIS may not have pushed this far into the province yet, but it was only a matter of time. Her girlfriends knew better, too. As embassy staffers, they were kept up to speed on the security situation, not only in Jordan, but also in neighboring Iraq and Syria. What they were doing was dangerous. But danger had been part of the weekend's appeal. It was an adventure, and adventures were supposed to be exciting. And what could be more exciting than partying at a CIA safe house for two nights? They had snuck out of work early on Friday, stopping back at their apartments only long enough to pick up their clothes and four enormous Yeti coolers, borrowed from an embassy storage room, filled with all sorts of food, including steaks, ice cream, beer, and even donuts. With a carefree attitude better suited to a trio of college co-eds headed off on spring break, they hopped into Ashley's Toyota Land Cruiser, turned up the music, and pointed the SUV toward the Karama-Trabil border crossing. Less than 3 hours later, they flashed their diplomatic passports and were waved through both the Jordanian and Iraqi checkpoints. Just beyond, Ashley's boyfriend and two of his teammates were waiting. A former U.S. Army Ranger, Ken Berglund, worked for the CIA's highly classified paramilitary detachment known as SAD, or Special Activities Division. He and his six-man team had been sitting in the crumbling desert fortress for over a week, waiting for the CIA to greenlight their insertion into Syria to snatch an ISIS HVT, or high-value target. Berglund's team was already running low on supplies when Langley informed them that the target had changed locations again, and there'd be another delay. The CIA wanted to keep the target under surveillance for a few days to see who he was meeting with. They'd decide what to do after that. Hurry up and wait. It was par for the course for operators. If Langley wanted to delay this mission, that was their decision. In the meantime, though, Berglund had made a decision of his own. Why not make their resupply a little more interesting? He and Ashley hadn't seen each other in months. When he asked her, she jumped at the chance. As long as she hit the road by Friday prayers, she'd be all right. There wasn't much to worry about between Amman and the border. She'd have her weapon with her, and if she needed to rock out with her Glock out, she could hold her own. Her father, who was ex-military, had taught her how to shoot at an early age. On top of her extensive CIA training, she practiced continually and took great pride in outshooting any man dumb enough to underestimate her. It was one of the many things Berglund loved about her. Not only was she this hot South Florida stunner, she was also her own woman, unafraid, unapologetic, and unaffected by who or what other people thought she should be. Her father, though, had his own plans for her. He hadn't wanted her getting anywhere near the Middle East, and had exerted great pressure to keep her back in the United States. But Ashley, being Ashley, she had found a way to get what she wanted. She always did, which concerned Berglund. While they'd gotten naughty a lot over FaceTime, he was worried she'd eventually need it in the flesh, and find it either at the embassy or somewhere else in the diplomatic community. The thought of her with some Eurotrash diplomat, or, God forbid, some Oorah embassy marine, was more than the former ranger could stand. Any rules he was breaking by bringing her out to the desert were worth it. But, as is often the case, one bad decision normally leads to another. The idea of steaks and pretty girls had appealed to the other men on the team, and so two of Ashley's friends had been invited as well. As far as the operators were concerned, what happened downrange stayed downrange. There was no reason anyone at Langley needed to know. Berglund turned his attention back to the T-bones, giving them a final 90-degree rotation to sear the perfect crosshatch marks into the meat, a technique he had learned one summer in college working at a steakhouse in Dallas. It was going to be an epic meal. Ashley had even laid her hands on the ingredients for a wedge salad. If only all of their deployments could be like this. When the steaks were ready, he stacked them on a plate, slung his M4, and headed toward the table. His helmet, mounted with night vision goggles, sat in a row with the others. Berglund was only halfway there when he heard the high-pitched whistle of an inbound mortar. Dropping the steaks, he raced toward the others, yelling, "Incoming! Get down! Get down!" Chapter 2. Hot, jagged pieces of rock flew in all directions as the first mortar exploded. It was immediately followed by two more. Scrambling for their gear, team members yelled out their call signs and that they were up, ready to engage in the fight. As they raced toward the areas they were responsible for covering, Berglund grabbed one of his junior guys, a man named Moss. Pointing at the women, he yelled, "Get them to the pit!" The pit was a subterranean interrogation facility from the days when the Iraqis had used the fort as a detention facility. It was the safest place for Ashley and her girlfriends. "And bring back the belt fed!" Berglund roared over the din, calling for the team's lightweight medium machine gun. The mortars continued to rain down, knocking out huge sections of wall and scoring a direct hit on the fort's last remaining tower as Moss rushed the women toward the stairs. At the bottom was a huge metal door that had been propped open with a large piece of stone. Moss herded the women inside, snatched up the 24-pound machine gun, and grabbed as many cans of .338 Norma Magnum ammo as he could carry. "Get to the back of the room," he instructed, "and don't come out until one of us comes for you." Knocking the stone out of the way, he bent his shoulder into the heavy door and gave it a shove. He was halfway up the stairs before it clanged shut. Outside on the fort's decrepit battlements, the gun battle was on. Berglund was firing his suppressed rifle in controlled bursts when Moss charged into the courtyard. "Hurry up with that belt fed," he shouted. Moss ran to him, dropped the ammo cans, and began setting up the weapon. "Did they get to the pit?" He was about to respond when another mortar round came screeching in, and exploded inside the courtyard. It blew out half the wall near the stairs, only feet from where he had just been.
"Did they get to the pit?"
Berglund repeated, yelling above the ringing in his ears.
"They're safe," Moss shouted back.
Berglund pointed with the barrel of his rifle toward the southeast.
"There's at least 50 of them, maybe more, armed with AKs and RPGs.
Who the hell are they?"
"Who the fuck cares? Start putting rounds on them."
Using the night vision scope mounted to the top of the machine gun, Moss flipped off the safety and opened fire. The .338 Norma Magnum round was incredibly accurate and exceedingly powerful. Its effective range was 2,000 yards, but it was capable of hitting targets at over 6,000. The General Dynamics lightweight medium machine gun could burn through 500 rounds a minute, and Moss was letting them have it. But no sooner had he dropped one group than another popped up. And now they were coming at the fort from different directions. It was a swarm. They were everywhere. Moss changed positions 6 times as one of the team members rushed to the pit to retrieve the rest of their ammo. Berglund had already called Langley over his encrypted satellite phone for help. He needed intel badly.
"Who are these guys? What are their numbers? And what kind of assets are in the area to come to the team's assistance?"
Langley didn't have any good answers for him. Whoever the attackers were, they had struck as the CIA's drone had come off station. A new UAV wouldn't be overhead for at least 20 more minutes. Retasking a satellite would take at least 30. Berglund didn't have 30 minutes. He doubted he even had 20. Pretty soon, they were going to be out of ammo. When that happened, this fight would be over. Complicating matters was the fact that the SAD team was not even supposed to be in Iraq. This was a completely black operation. The CIA, though, wasn't going to let its people die. In an abandoned warehouse back across the Jordanian border sat a commercial 18-wheel vehicle. Hidden inside its long white trailer were two heavily modified Hughes MD-500 helicopters with their rotor blades folded in.
"Let's move! Let's move!" the CIA crew chief yelled as the birds were rolled out and hastily prepped for launch.
Their fastest time ever from truck to takeoff was 4.5 minutes. If they had any hope of helping Berglund's team, they were going to need to cut that time in half. The helicopters, CIA versions of the U.S. Army's MH-6 Little Birds, had been pre-positioned on the Jordanian side of the border as a Plan B. Plan A was for Berglund and his men to roll into Syria via 3 separate vehicles, put a bag over the head of their ISIS target, and roll back out. The helicopters were only there in case something went wrong during the mission. An attack of this magnitude, at such a remote location, when no one should have known that they were there, had been considered almost impossible. But here were Berglund and his men, with only minutes left to live. The aviation team wasn't even aware of the unauthorized visitors hiding beneath the fort in the pit. Swinging his index finger urgently above his head, the crew chief barked for the pilots to fire up their birds.
"Get 'em hot! Let's go! Now! Now! Now!"
As 4 support personnel snapped, slapped, and racked the helicopter's weapon systems into place, the noise in the warehouse was pierced by the high-pitched whine of the engines coming to life. Moments later, loose panes of glass began falling from the warehouse windows as the vibrating rotors chopped hungrily at the air. When the pilots flashed the thumbs up, the crew chief gave the signal for the warehouse doors to be opened, and he set the birds loose. Lifting off the concrete floor in unison, the MD-500s hovered over to the exit and took off. The team had beaten their all-time best record by 1:18. It was a valiant effort and might have made the difference, except for what happened next. 3 kilometers out from the fort, as the co-pilots in each helicopter went hot with their weapon systems, a pair of surface-to-air missiles locked onto the heat from the engines. Neither of the helicopters had a chance. Berglund didn't need Langley to tell him what had happened. He could see the explosions in the night sky for himself. Emptying the last round of his rifle mag, he set it down and transitioned to his pistol. In his oversized Texas way, he had thought he was being cute when he had welcomed Ashley and her girlfriends to the Anbar Alamo. Whether that had been prophetic or ironic didn't much matter at this point. With their vehicles destroyed by mortar fire and the helicopters shot down, they had no choice but to make their stand here. Even if jets could be scrambled out of Jordan, they wouldn't arrive until it was too late. This was going to be it. Berglund was a warrior, and that's how he would go out, on his feet, taking as many of the enemy with him as possible. He only had two regrets, that he hadn't better hidden Ashley, and that he never got a chance to eat his steak. Sasha Basayev was impressed. The Americans had fought harder than he had expected. Even after running out of ammunition, they had drawn their knives and tried to fight with their hands. Only two remained alive. Both were beyond any hope of medical treatment, though. He told the videographers to hurry up and get to work. Walking across the rubble-strewn courtyard, he approached the coolers. Brushing off a layer of debris, he removed a flashlight and opened one of the lids. Reaching inside, he found it to be full of ice, an incredible luxury in the middle of the desert. He then went to the next cooler, and the next, studying their contents. Bottles of pink wine? Pastries? Ice cream? As decadent as the Americans were, these provisions made no sense, even for a CIA paramilitary team. Strewn across the ground near the last cooler were steaks. Basayev reached down and touched one. It was still warm. He counted nine of them. Nine steaks for a six-man team. Considering how big some of the Americans were, perhaps a few planned to consume more than one steak. But that still didn't explain the wine he had seen. American men, particularly military men, usually drank beer or hard liquor. If they drank wine at all, it certainly wouldn't be pink. Something wasn't right. The contents of the coolers looked like catering for a picnic or some sort of American beach party. Then, his flashlight caught a reflection a few feet away. Underneath more debris, he found an iPhone clad in a rhinestone case. Its password-protected screen was cracked, but the image of a woman kissing one of the CIA fighters was clearly visible. This was indeed a blessing. Holding it up in the air, he called out to his fighters in Arabic. "There is a woman here," he shouted, "an American woman. If you find her, you can have her." A cheer rose from the jihadists as a handful of them rushed into the stairwell. In the passageway below, it took two of them to pry open the pit door. The first man to force his way in took two shots to the chest and one to the head. Another gunfight was on. This one, though, was much shorter. Ashley only had two spare magazines. When her pistol ran dry, the jihadists poured in. Her colleagues were clerical workers. They didn't carry weapons. It took only seconds for the unspeakable to begin. Chapter 3. Sunday. Vienna, Austria. Scott Harvath wasn't trying to hide. He expected to be seen. That was the plan. Be brief, be bloody, be gone. There would be hand-wringing by the Austrians, of course, but the politics of the assignment weren't his concern. The White House had been crystal clear. Either the Europeans dealt with their problem, or the United States would. Harvath sat in a corner of the Café Havelka. A suppressed Beretta rested beneath a newspaper in his lap. Art posters covered the faded walls. The place smelled like chocolate and stale cigarettes. Taking a final sip of his coffee, he stood and set the newspaper on the table. His target was sitting with another man near the window. Both were in their early 30s. Neither looked up. Approaching the table, Harvath said only, "Paris." Then placing the suppressor under the man's jaw, pulled the trigger. Even though the Beretta was suppressed, the shot was still audible, and the man's brains, splattered across the cafe window, were extremely visible. Patrons screamed and knocked over tables and chairs in a rush to escape. Others sat frozen, either in shock or out of self-preservation, hoping not to attract the shooter's attention. The CIA director wanted a Rembrandt, big, bold, and unmistakable. Harvath had delivered. Exiting via the rear of the cafe, he took off his cap, disassembled the weapon, and slid everything into his pockets. 6 blocks away, he walked into the Hotel Zacher. Tipping the coat check girl, he reclaimed his overcoat and shopping bags. He then used the men's room to clean up and change clothes. He stood at the sink and washed his hands. There would be multiple descriptions of him given to police. None of them would be accurate. The bystanders had been transfixed by the violence and the speed at which it had happened. His waiter would remember only that he was a white male, maybe in his 30s, who had quietly placed his order in German. If they were able to track him all the way to the Hotel Zacher, the coat check girl might describe him as handsome. He doubted that she'd be able to add 5'10", sandy brown hair and blue eyes to her description. Either way, he'd already be gone. Outside the hotel, he had the doorman hail him a cab for the main train station. There he laid a false trail by purchasing a ticket for Klagenfurt, a village near the border. Exiting the station, he walked a few blocks to a nearby U-Bahn platform and hopped on the subway for 6 stops. He poked around an obscure Vienna neighborhood for 20 minutes, then found a cab to take him to Ristorante Va Bene near the river. Confident no one was following him, he sat outside and had a beer. He was cutting it close. The ship would be leaving soon. He needed that beer, though. More than the beer, it was the 5 minutes of quiet he needed. 5 minutes to get his head out of one game and into the next. He hadn't run an operation this way before. Trying to serve 2 masters was never a good idea. It didn't matter how smart you were begging for something to go wrong. And when things started going wrong, mistakes started piling up, along with the bodies. He looked down at his watch. So much for 5 minutes of peace. Pulling some cash from his pocket, he threw back the rest of the beer, paid his bill, and left. It was just over a mile to the port of Vienna. Along the way, he tossed the Beretta, and then the suppressor, into the Danube. He retrieved the Ziploc bag he had taped beneath a dumpster, with his passport, keycard, and other personal effects. Putting everything back in his pockets, he ran one more mental check as he patted himself down. He didn't want to get caught with anything tying him to what had happened at the cafe. Stepping onto the ship's gangway, he presented his embarkment card and smiled at the crew. They put his shopping bags onto the belt of the X-ray machine and had him walk through the magnetometer. In the 4 days he had been on the ship, he had noticed 100 ways a terrorist or other bad actor could wreak havoc. None of them involved sneaking something through the magnetometer or the X-ray machine. Receiving the all clear, the crew handed him his items and welcomed him back aboard. One cheerful staffer began to ask if he had enjoyed his time ashore, but he was halfway across the lobby before she could finish. Arriving at his stateroom, he paused at the door and listened. Nothing. Fishing out his key card, he let himself in. It was dark. He began to reach for the light, but stopped himself. The sliding glass door was open. A figure was standing on his balcony. Chapter 4. Harvath had known this was coming. He didn't want it, but it was inevitable. Dropping the bags on the couch, he walked out onto the balcony. Lara Cordero was leaning against the rail with a glass of champagne in her hand. Her tight dress clung to her stunning body as a faint breeze moved her long brown hair. She could have been a model for the cruise line. She looked gorgeous. "How'd it go?" she asked. gazing across the Danube. He hadn't told her what he was doing, but she wasn't stupid. He had been bombarded with calls and emails since they had arrived in Europe. He was also carrying a smartphone she had never seen before. She knew enough about him to put two and two together. He had promised her a vacation last fall, right before a megalomaniac at the United Nations engineered a devastating global pandemic. While it burned itself out, he and Lara had taken refuge in Alaska. Under the circumstances, it wasn't exactly the getaway either of them had envisioned. A cruise along the Danube was much more like it, at least for Lara. Harvath had a secondary agenda, and that's why he had suggested it. Islamic terrorism had exploded in Europe. Americans had been killed. The United States had been unequivocal about what it expected its European allies to do. It was time for the gloves to come off. They were at war. The terrorists hid among the very people they were slaughtering. They used the freedom and openness of the West to strike at soft targets like churches, cafes, restaurants, bars, transit centers, tourist attractions, sporting events, concerts, movie theaters, and schools. They were not legitimate combatants. They were savages. To expect any mercy from the nations upon whom they preyed was the height of insanity. They respected one thing and one thing only: force. Abu Bakr al-Shishani was responsible for a string of terror attacks in Paris that had killed multiple Americans. The fact that he moved about so openly in Vienna showed how little he feared any reprisal. Harvath had taken care of that, though. It was meant to be a message to the rest of them. If they killed Americans, America would kill them. It didn't matter where they were or how long it took. Harvath was happy to be the messenger. Moving in and out of Vienna via boat was too good an opportunity for Harvath to pass up. The cruise provided him with the perfect cover. It also provided him with a chance to have his cake and eat it too. He and Lara were at a crossroads. They needed the vacation, but they needed it in order to sort out what was going to happen next. The pandemic, though short-lived, had been brutal. It seemed everyone knew someone who had been impacted. That included Lara. Two of her superiors had succumbed, and because of it, she had been offered an amazing promotion. The Boston Police Department wanted to elevate her from homicide detective to commander of the entire unit. It was an incredible opportunity, but it meant she would have to remain in Boston. In the hope that she might relocate, Harvath had been reaching out to his contacts in and around D.C. They were all feeling a similar pinch. They had lost exceptional people, but wanted to promote from within. The chance Lara was being offered wasn't going to be matched anywhere else. Although it killed him to admit it, it was the best decision she could make. He respected her sense of loyalty to a department that had always had her back and a city that she loved. There were other factors at play as well. Her aging parents lived in the apartment right beneath hers. They were too old to leave Boston and start over. All of their friends were there. They were a tight family. The idea of Lara's son growing up in Virginia without his grandparents just downstairs also didn't sit well. If they couldn't make the move together, she didn't want to make the move at all. Harvath understood. He loved her enough to want what was best for her, to accept the promotion. He also loved her enough to want their last trip together to be special. His moving to Boston was pretty much a non-starter. He couldn't do his job long distance. The CIA had him under contract now, and the president demanded a lot of face time. With the country's aggressive new stance on terrorism, he was only going to get busier. It wasn't an easy conclusion to come to. 10 years from now, or maybe even just 5, his thinking might have been different. But not now. Not at this moment. Too much was at stake. The world was growing more dangerous. Some derided the American dream. Not Harvath. He knew that the American dream couldn't survive without people willing to protect it. He had always put the country ahead of himself. He had done it as a SEAL and had continued to do it in a variety of capacities ever since. That wasn't going to stop, no matter how much it personally pained or cost him. Right after Paris, he'd had a conversation with the president. In it, he shared his theory that there were wolves and then there were sheep. In order to protect the sheep, the nation needed sheepdogs, and that's how he saw himself. The president thought about it for several moments before sharing his own view. Yes, the United States needed its sheepdogs, but it also needed wolf hunters. That was how the president saw Harvath best helping to protect the sheep. "We're not going to wait for the wolves to come to us," he had said. "We're going to go to them, where they live, where they eat, where they sleep. We'll hunt them with a ferocity the likes of which they have never seen. If they so much as look in our direction, we will take them out." It was one of the most powerful statements Harvath had ever heard. It hadn't been made for the cameras or to score political points. It was the man's core ideological belief, and it only served to deepen Harvath's respect for him. "Take off the chains and let us do our jobs." It was a statement made over and over again by spies and special operations personnel. Now, Harvath was getting his chance. He didn't intend to let it slip by. Pulling the cold bottle of champagne from the bucket, he poured himself a glass.
"Can we at least enjoy Budapest together tomorrow before we have to fly home?"
she asked, still facing out toward the river. He walked over and wrapped his arms around her. Kissing the back of her neck, he was about to respond when his phone vibrated. Chapter 5. Monday, Washington, D.C. Senator Daniel Wells leaned forward and studied the man on the other side of his desk.
"Did I stutter?"
he asked. His jacket hung on the back of his chair and his sleeves were rolled up.
"No, sir," replied his guest. "Was I speaking in a foreign language?"
"No, sir," the man repeated in a frustrated tone, tired of the condescension from the arrogant Iowa senator. He was the worst kind of politician. Even in the aftermath of the pandemic, he was all about furthering his own agenda.
13 Americans are dead. 13,
Wells barked.
"And you don't have a fucking clue what happened? Not one piece of information?"
"Sir, if I could just—" Wells cut him off.
"Stop calling me sir. I am a United States senator."
"Yes, senator. I didn't mean to—" Wells ignored him and plowed on.
"It's your duty as director of the CIA to keep my committee informed."
"We're still trying to unpack what happened."
"Let's start with what the hell you were doing in Anbar."
Their conversation was drifting into dangerous territory. Bob McGee chose his words carefully.
"Looking for high-ranking ISIS figures."
"You deployed a 6-man SAD team to the Syrian border, along with heavily armed, multi-million-dollar covert aviation assets, just to look around?"
The CIA director nodded. He was in his late 50s, with wavy salt-and-pepper hair and a thick mustache.
"You're full of shit. That's why we have a drone program. What were you really doing there?"
"Senator, as I said, looking for high-ranking ISIS figures."
Wells glared at him. He was getting nowhere.
"And the collection management officer? What about her? What was she doing there?"
They were officially in dangerous territory now. Nevertheless, McGee decided to give him a straight answer.
"I don't know why Ashley Foster was there."
"Bullshit.
Senator, you have my word that—"
"What about the other two?" Wells interrupted. "The two additional women from the embassy?"
The CIA director shook his head.
"We're still not sure."
Wells glared at him.
"What about the video? Have you even seen it?"
McGee was tempted to glare right back at him. Had he seen it? Of course he had. The whole world had seen it by now. ISIS had wasted no time in putting it out. It was beyond barbaric. The women had been made to do unspeakable things with the body parts of the deceased SAD members. They were then brutally raped and tortured before being murdered. One could even be heard crying for her father to come save her. Even for a group as depraved as ISIS, it was sickening. "Savages," said McGee, acknowledging that he had indeed seen it.
"Can you imagine what the families are going through?"
"I can't possibly—"
"You're damn right you can't," Wells broke in.
"I don't know what kind of game you're playing, but as far as I'm concerned, the CIA is fully responsible for the deaths of those Americans."
McGee could see where this was going now. Wells hated the agency. He was going to hang everything on Langley, if not on him personally. The senator was a petty, vindictive man who had done everything in his power to block McGee's confirmation. He had never thought him a good choice for director. He had wanted someone with more political skin in the game, a careerist he could manipulate. But that was precisely why the president had selected McGee. He wasn't seen as an insider. He didn't play the game. He had a long history at the CIA, but on the ops side, not management. That was a plus as far as the president was concerned. McGee cared deeply about the CIA and about repairing its broken culture. He was the perfect pick to muck its Augean stables. As director of Central Intelligence, McGee had swung the axe without mercy. The agency needed to get back to its roots. There were too many bureaucrats, too many middle managers more concerned with their next promotion than the men and women in the field. McGee fired more people at the CIA than had been fired in the last 3 decades. He went after the waste, fraud, and abuse like the cancer it was. That included people friendly with Senator Wells, people who thought Wells would protect their positions. The senator had been quite upset about the layoffs. His pull inside the agency was waning. He was losing good sources of information and influence. People who owed him favors were being cut loose. It didn't take him long to push back by subtly threatening the new director. "You worry about the CIA and I'll worry about Wells," the president had told McGee. Up until now, it was a strategy that had worked. But Anbar had just changed everything. It would only accelerate the ambitions of Senator Wells. Though he hadn't yet announced, everyone knew he was going to challenge the president in the next election. Anbar and that sick video must have looked like a gift from heaven. McGee had no intention of helping Wells. "As soon as I have a better picture of what happened," he said, "I'll be happy to brief the committee."
"No, you'll brief me. And I don't care how many asses you have to kick or kiss, you'd better have something for me soon."
McGee nodded and began to stand.
"If that's all, I'll be—"
"Sit down," Wells bellowed. "I'm not finished."
It took everything McGee had not to throat punch the man, but he complied.
"What do you know about Vienna?" Wells demanded.
Without thinking it through, he replied, "It's the capital of Austria."
"You want to mess with me, Director McGee? Is that it? How funny do you think it'll be when the CIA gets its funding cut?"
McGee knew better than to be a smart aleck. Wells wasn't just an arrogant jackass. He was an extremely powerful, arrogant jackass. That made him dangerous. It would be political suicide for Wells to cut off funding. He'd never do it. He could, though, slow it down. If that happened, it would cause all sorts of problems for the CIA. That was the barrel he had McGee over, and McGee despised him for it. He hated having to kowtow to self-serving clowns like Wells. But what he hated even more was the thought of his people at the CIA not getting what they needed. Money was oxygen in the intelligence business. If it were to be cut off, everything would cease to function. He couldn't risk that. "Vienna," McGee said, pushing his ego aside.
"You're referring to the hit on Al-Shishani?"
"No,
I'm referring to their fucking schnitzel. Of course I'm referring to the hit on Al-Shishani.
What do you know about it?
Everything, thought McGee, none of which I'm going to share with you.
Looking the senator right in the eye, the CIA director replied, We think the French wanted to send a message.
The French? Because the shooter allegedly mentioned Paris? Said Wells,
thinking about it for a moment. I don't buy it. Not their style. The Israelis, maybe. But they don't have a dog in this part of the fight.
McGee shrugged. You asked me what I knew.
And you haven't told me shit, said Wells.
Our government has checks and balances for a reason. If I find out that you, or the president, have been operating outside constitutional authority, I'll rain hell down upon you both. Do you understand me?
Yes, sir, I do, McGee said, pressing the man's buttons once more as he stood.
Will that be all, sir?
Wells stared daggers at him.
Get the fuck out of my office.
Leaving the senator's office, McGee knew two things. One, he hated Wells more than ever. And two, if Harvath didn't figure out who was behind the Anbar debacle, they were all going to be in a lot of trouble. Chapter 6. Brussels, Belgium. In Budapest, the CIA had a gray Mercedes waiting for them at the dock. Lara was going to the Four Seasons. Harvath was going to the airport. They were both exhausted. Neither had wanted to face the raw emotion of their separation. It had been easier to let two bottles of champagne dull as much of it as possible, and they'd had one final wild night. They were a great couple, smart, passionate, and electric together. The fact that they couldn't figure out how to make something so good work in the same city was crazy. When it came time for the actual goodbye, Lara gave him one of the best kisses he'd ever had. Long, slow, sexy. Then, she got out of the car, grabbed her bag from the trunk, and walked into the hotel. Harvath sat in the back seat and stared at the polished glass doors.
What the hell just happened? He wondered. It was like all the oxygen was just sucked out of his lungs.
Did I really let her walk?
Several moments passed as he sat there and tried to sort it all out. His driver finally interrupted his thoughts.
Are we ready to head to the airport, sir?
The short answer was no. He wasn't ready to head to the airport. He wanted to chase Lara up to her room, lock the door, and pretend he hadn't said yes to Brussels. But he couldn't do that. He had given his word. Harvath usually enjoyed traveling by private jet, especially on something as luxurious as a Dassault Falcon 5X. But even its dramatic skylight failed to impress him today. He mixed salt, sugar, and ground aspirin into a tall glass of tomato juice over ice. It tasted horrible. After downing another, he stretched out on the white leather couch with a large bottle of water. The CIA used an encrypted app that only allowed him to watch the Anbar video and view the image files once. It was more than enough. ISIS was an Islamic death cult trying to usher in an apocalypse. The larger they grew, the more depraved they became. Their ultimate goal was to meet the infidel in Dabiq, a tiny village in northern Syria. After a decisive ground battle, the Muslim Messiah would return, or so the ancient prophecy went. Harvath was willing to bet that the Prophet Muhammad had never envisioned nuclear weapons. If it were up to Harvath, he'd let the nukes fly. After dropping leaflets warning residents to flee, he'd flatten Dabiq and then Raqqa, the ISIS capital. There'd be no ground battle. There'd only be fields of glass. The ISIS savages were not worth another drop of American blood. But it wasn't up to Harvath. It was up to the President of the United States, who for the moment had a different plan. He wanted to know how the SAD team in Iraq had come under attack. How had ISIS known they were there? Harvath had gathered the intelligence for the operation. He was the one who had identified and pinpointed the high-value ISIS target. The information had come from his contacts. Now, 13 Americans were dead. the CIA had launched an immediate investigation. They learned that Ashley Foster had been in a relationship with one of the SAD team members. She had convinced two girlfriends from the embassy to join her for the weekend and party at the safe house. Phone records, texts, and emails all backed it up. It was a case of extremely bad judgment across the board. The ISIS attack, though, was another matter. The jihadists had come ready for the fight. They had not only overwhelmed the SAD team, but had also downed two CIA helicopters. They knew exactly what they were up against. They even brought a video crew. Had they known the women were going to be there too? All of this was what Harvath had been tasked with figuring out, and Square One was in Brussels. The city was more than 25% Muslim, and its most concentrated Islamic neighborhood was Molenbeek. Sitting on the wrong side of the canal, it boasted more than 24 mosques. It also boasted one of Harvath's best contacts, a contact who had suddenly gone dark. Either Salah Abaoud was in trouble, or Harvath had been double-crossed. If he'd been double-crossed, there wasn't a hole deep enough for Salah to hide in. Harvath would find him. It was what he did. Salah was a doctor with a storefront practice. Everyone in Molenbeek knew him. He was the unofficial mayor of the neighborhood. He settled disputes, helped new Muslim immigrants navigate the Belgian welfare system, pulled bad teeth, and even arranged marriages. He was a generous contributor to local mosques and charities, drove a bright red BMW, and always had tickets to the best sporting matches. By all outward appearances, Dr. Salah Abaoud was a successful man. No one in the neighborhood had any clue about his criminal past. Even the Belgian government was in the dark. Back in the Middle East, Salah had made a fortune as a smuggler. Leveraging his position as a doctor, he had exploited Red Crescent, UN, and a host of other medical relief missions and convoys. He smuggled everything from stolen antiquities, drugs, and weapons to people. It was the weapons, though, that had gotten him caught. At one point, he was moving a crate of stolen missiles from Morocco to Lebanon. Harvath had been tracking the cell behind the theft. One piece of information led to another, until Harvath ended up on Salah's doorstep. The only thing that had saved the doctor's life was his willingness to cooperate. With all his connections, Salah was in a position to know things. He had an impressive network, and Harvath wanted it. Salah agreed to a generous monthly stipend and was allowed to continue breathing. Allah had doubly blessed him. Harvath assigned him the codename Sidewinder after the missiles Salah had been caught smuggling. But as time wore on, he realized the actual rattlesnake was an even better fit. Salah's blood was cold. He made a lot of noise when he was upset, and he could strike without warning. The man required delicate handling. Right now, though, Harvath wasn't in the mood to be delicate. 13 Americans were dead. 10 of them had been operating on intelligence he had gathered. The other 3 had just been in the wrong place at the wrong time. None of them, though, would have been there if it wasn't for him. That was a fact, and it weighed on him. He tried to put it out of his mind as he hunted for Salah. The first place he checked was the man's house, but there was no sign of him or his red BMW. Next was the clinic. It was locked up tight. Through the window, Harvath could see a stack of mail piled up on the floor. Had Salah skipped town? Had he fled the country? Harvath's concerns over being double-crossed began to rise. There was only one other place he could think to look for him. Salah's piety had a limit. It ended right at his erogenous zone. He kept a love nest along with a well-stocked liquor cart in the fashionable Saint-Gilles neighborhood. Harvath had followed him there once. The apartment was located just off the Avenue Louise. If the true measure of a person's character was what they did when no one was watching, Dr. Salah Abaoud would have scandalized the Muslims of Brussels. In addition to being a semi-professional alcoholic. He was screwing the very attractive, very much younger, and very married nurse from his clinic, Aisha. Harvath stood outside the door and listened. What was he expecting to hear? Sex? Even a man as gluttonous as Salah wouldn't disappear for days on a bender. He was too careful. He had too much invested in his public image. Not so much, though, that it stopped him from screwing or drinking. He had simply gotten used to a certain level of risk. Harvath could hear something coming from inside. It sounded like screaming, but it definitely wasn't sex. A soccer game? He twisted the knob of the brass bell in the center of the door and waited. The last time he had walked in on Salah, he had gotten more than an eyeful. Full frontal of any man, much less that fat and that hairy, was something he never needed to see again. No one came to the door. After waiting a few more moments, he removed a credit card-sized piece of steel from his pocket. Lockpick tools had been carved into it with a laser. All he had to do was pop out the ones he needed. Studying the lock, he was in the process of selecting a pick when he decided to try the handle. The door was unlocked. Salah never left anything unlocked. Pushing the door open, he could see all the way into the apartment without stepping inside. Someone had been here, and they had created their own Rembrandt. Chapter 7. There was no sign of a struggle, no torture. Salah sat on the couch in a gold and purple robe, with his head tipped back. A corona of blood was splattered on the wall behind him. On the table was a highball, half filled with what was probably his favorite bourbon. The TV was on, probably had been for days. Harvath stepped inside and closed the door. The scent of tea and spices was overpowered by the odor of death. He needed to make this quick. Standing in the vestibule, he took everything in. The hit looked professional. Salah had been shot once in the head. As no one had called the police, the killer had probably used a suppressed weapon. That ruled out Aisha's husband and an act of passion. Making his way into the master bedroom, Harvath noticed an unmade bed, Salah's clothes over the back of a chair, and a woman's clothes draped across a chaise near the window. Faint light glowed from the bathroom. Harvath had a bad feeling about what he was going to find inside. Moving over to the door, he nudged it open. Aisha lay naked and dead in the tub. Someone had shot her once in the head, just like Salah. The tiles behind her were bright red with her blood, the bathwater a deep rose. Stepping out of the bathroom, Harvath walked back through the apartment. It was definitely a professional hit. Nothing appeared to have been stolen. Salah still wore his gold Rolex Daytona. The two Chagalls still hung in the living room, and all the jewelry he had purchased for Aisha, which she could never bring home, sat in a red velvet box on her dressing table. The killer was not only professional, but disciplined. This ruled out most, if not all, of the underworld and jihadist figures Salah conducted business with. If any of them had had a beef with the smuggler, Harvath would have heard about it. Salah frequently abused their relationship in order to settle his business disputes. He knew there were certain clients that the U.S. would gladly take out for him. In fact, the CIA sometimes scrawled AGFSA on the missiles its drones use for such assignments. A gift from Salah Abaoud. Salah's success rate in identifying and locating terrorist targets was why the CIA had taken his recent ISIS intel so seriously. But now look at him, Harvath thought, as he examined the body. He had definitely been here a couple of days. So if it wasn't a jealous husband or a disgruntled business associate, who killed him? The professionalism of the hit made it look like a state sponsor, carried out by some country's intelligence service. Harvath immediately ruled out any services allied with the United States. He had flagged Salah across the board. If MI6, the Mossad, or anyone like that had wanted him, it should have been brought to his attention. Could it have been a Middle Eastern nation like Morocco, Egypt, or Saudi Arabia? Possibly, but they were pretty bad at projecting force much beyond their own borders. And if it were one of them, why would they expend that kind of effort over Saleh? It didn't make sense. There were a lot more questions coming to his mind than answers. One thing, though, was certain. Saleh was proving just as much a pain in the ass dead as he had been alive. Harvath continued to carefully move through the apartment as he looked for clues. The last thing he wanted was to leave anything that would tie him to the scene. He wanted Belgian authorities focused on catching the real killer. And whoever that was, he had chosen to splash Saleh here, rather than at his home or his clinic. Why? Based on the evidence, it looked like he had caught Saleh by surprise. Having just had sex, he was watching TV and enjoying a drink, while his mistress took a bath. The assassin appeared to have only one goal, to kill him right where he found him. But if that was the case, why not then turn and leave? Why walk back to the bathroom and kill Aisha? Time. If he had just turned and left, it wouldn't have taken Aisha long to find Saleh's body. Would she, the unfaithful wife, have called the police? Maybe. Would she have screamed and drawn the attention of neighbors? It was possible, and a professional would have taken it all into consideration. This was particularly true of someone who needed to get out of the country. The more time he had before the police even knew he was there, the better his chances, especially if he was leaving by plane or rail. Pulling out his phone, Harvath took pictures of everything. Geotagging the location, he transmitted the images back to his team in the United States. He included a message with it for his IT expert, Nicholas. Known to global intelligence services as the Troll, Nicholas suffered from a condition known as primordial dwarfism. Though he stood less than 3 feet high, Nicholas was a digital savant who had built a name through the purchase, sale, and theft of highly sensitive black market information. He had made powerful enemies in his career, and though he had gone straight, his two enormous white Caucasian Ovcharka dogs were always at his side, just in case.
"Professional job," Harvath's message read. "Possible foreign intel service. Pull surrounding CCTV footage. See if you can track the hitter."
Returning to the bedroom, Harvath removed the keys from Saleh's trousers and exited the apartment. By the time he arrived back in Molenbeek, it was already dark, and residents were at evening prayers. He decided to check Saleh's clinic first. Unlocking the front door, he stepped over the pieces of mail and slipped inside. Saleh's personal office was in the back. Harvath didn't know what he was looking for. A professional hitter coming after Saleh was one thing. A professional hitter coming after Saleh, right on the heels of the attack in Anbar, was something entirely different. Until he had reason to suspect otherwise, Harvath was going to consider the two events connected. You didn't live very long in this line of work by believing in coincidences. He made a quick pass of Saleh's office, but everything seemed to be in place. It didn't look like anyone had been here at all. Turning on the clinic computers, Harvath inserted a portable flash drive with a program that would allow Nicholas access. Once the program was uploaded, he removed the drive and headed for Saleh's house. It was a bland, three-story brick structure. The ground floor, where Saleh held meetings and received people from the neighborhood, was modestly decorated. The second and third stories were much more lavish. The color scheme for these levels was similar to the robe Saleh had been shot in, lots of purple and gold. Overstuffed couches sat on thick Persian carpets, accented by ornate chairs and heavy draperies. Paintings of plump, naked women and bowls of fruit adorned the walls. The musty air was laden with the sickly sweet, overly perfumed smell of incense. Harvath used his elbow to open a set of French windows and let in some air. Moving from room to room, he took note of what he saw. Dirty breakfast dishes sat in the sink. A coffee cup rested on the windowsill in the bathroom. A 3-day-old newspaper lay open on the dining room table. It didn't look like anyone but Sala had been here since then. Either the murder was revenge for something very far in Sala's past, or he had been killed in order to keep him quiet. Harvath was betting on quiet. But quiet about what? There had to be something in the house that would tell him. Returning to the study, he opened Sala's desk drawers and began going through his personal papers. Most of them were written in Arabic. It was a language Harvath had some proficiency in speaking, but reading was all but out of the question. He was going to have to bag everything and get it to an agency translator. He was coming back from the bedroom with a pillowcase when he got a text on his phone.
"Recognize this guy?"
the message from Nicholas asked. A photograph followed. It showed a thin, almost feminine-looking young man, with pale skin and blonde hair that was nearly white. He wore a short-sleeved dress shirt and a narrow black tie.
"No. Who is he?"
Harvath typed back. Within seconds, his phone vibrated. It was a call from Nicholas.
"His name is Sasha Besayev,"
the little man said, from more than 3,000 miles away back in Northern Virginia.
"2 years ago, the FBI debriefed a Russian intelligence officer seeking political asylum. He came ready to play. Besayev was on a list of names he gave up."
"Why are we talking about him?"
"I'm getting there," Nicholas replied. "You remember the Beslan school siege and the Moscow theater massacre?"
Harvath knew them well. They were huge mass casualty events. Beslan was a horrific 3-day attack in which 1,100 people were taken hostage. 385 were murdered, 186 of them children. The attack on the Moscow theater resulted in 900 hostages, 170 of whom were killed. They were textbook cases studied by America's premier counterterrorism and hostage rescue personnel.
"I remember," said Harvath. "Was carried out by Islamic terrorists, Chechens. Is there some other nexus?"
"A deputy director of the GRU, Russia's largest foreign intelligence service, lost his wife and daughter at the theater that night. After a long leave of absence, some believe to hunt terrorists in the Caucasus, he returned to the GRU and received permission to establish a new unit."
"What kind of unit?"
"An assassinations unit."
"Were they part of the response at Beslan?"
Harvath asked.
"No, they came after."
"To hunt down the rest of the terrorists?"
There was a pause.
"To recruit,"
Nicholas replied.
"From among the survivors? The children?"
"Who better to send after the devil than someone who had already been through hell? At least, that was their thinking."
Harvath had once recruited a hijacking survivor to help ID a terrorist, but that was different. What the Russians were attempting was insanity.
"I'd be stunned if any of those kids were capable of being a functional adult, much less an operative who could follow orders in high-stress environments."
Nicholas agreed.
"All of the recruits washed out. They either buckled under the pressure or were so aggressive that it bordered on psychotic."
"Except for one, I'm guessing?"
"Correct. Sasha Basayev. No matter what they threw at him, he excelled."
"So now, we're back to my previous question," said Harvath. "Why are we talking about him?"
"Because I think he's your assassin."
Chapter 8. Antalya, Turkish Riviera. Plastic surgery had made Sasha Basayev a man of nondescript features and indeterminate origin. All the better for him to move in and out of places he wasn't supposed to be. He stood 5'9", but could look taller or shorter just by how he carried himself. He was remarkable in that he was completely unremarkable. Even when he stood next to others, they usually failed to notice him. He was the quintessential gray man who faded into the background. He was one of the best weapons the Russians had ever created against Islamic extremists. He had been trained to infiltrate their ranks and destroy them from within. He was exceptional at it. But with Anbar, he had taken what he did to an entirely new level. The Russians had laid an elaborate trap for the United States. His job was to bait it. That's why he was now in Turkey. He was running a cell of ISIS fighters from an old warehouse. It was in a part of the city where few people spoke, and even fewer asked questions. A perfect location for a safe house. Tonight, Basayev's oiled hair was black, his eyes brown. His knowledge of the Quran was as deep as the ocean. So deep was it that the brothers chose him to lead them in prayer. It was only natural. In their eyes, he was the most pious, the most devout among them. He was their leader. Their faith in him was absolute, and they had willingly ingested the pills he had given them. Though drugs were frowned upon in Islam, exceptions were made in preparation for battle. Their bodies relaxed, and their minds began to float free. It was a religious experience in itself, a hint of what awaited them in paradise. One of the men, his eyes dilated, smiled and said,
"Insha'Allah, we will be victorious tomorrow, Brother Ibrahim."
Ibrahim al-Masri was Basayev's nom de guerre. He had adopted it years earlier when he had joined a radical madrasa in the Caucasus. From there, he infiltrated his first Muslim extremist group in Chechnya. They had no idea of the deadly viper they had welcomed into their ranks. Basayev collected intelligence on the organization that resulted in several high-ranking members being taken out. He also did some of the killing himself, making it all look accidental. When he used his jihadist connections to move on to ISIS, his reputation preceded him. Many fearsome acts had already become attached to the name Ibrahim al-Masri. In Iraq and Syria, he slaughtered many enemies of ISIS. And as he did, his fame and prominence within the organization grew. They came to consider him a fierce lion, but it wasn't always this way. At first, his superiors had been wary of him. His travel patterns had troubled them. The young fighter came and went, never staying longer than a couple of months. It appeared he wasn't fully committed to the struggle. But when he started showing up with things they needed, their image of him began to change. He was proficient at finding hard-to-get items like medicines and blank passports, night vision equipment, and infrared laser devices. He then began helping develop recruiting strategies and planning attacks. Eventually, Brother Ibrahim came to be seen as a valuable asset and a rising star within ISIS. As the caliphate grew, he was offered a governorship, but he politely turned it down. Rationing fuel, settling petty squabbles, and overseeing councils were not for him. Allah, he explained, had blessed him with the skill and stamina to fight. His sword was meant to sing, not hang in a scabbard on a wall. The powers that be understood. They were better off with him not sitting behind a desk. They allowed him broad autonomy and continued to be rewarded for it. Everything had unfolded just the way the GRU had planned. He was on the inside. No one doubted Ibrahim al-Masri's sincerity or devotion to the cause. Unrolling his rug on the floor of the warehouse, he led the men in evening prayers. He knew the words so well that he could say them in his sleep. He had been placed with an Arabic-speaking family and fully immersed in Islamic culture since his teens. Now in his late 20s, he could converse like a scholar on everything from the conquests of the Prophet Muhammad to the failures of pan-Arab nationalism and the rise of the caliphate. Many core ISIS members possessed advanced degrees, and intelligence, especially at the top levels of the organization, was very highly prized. Intelligent men went far and were handsomely rewarded. ISIS saw to it. The men he had gathered here in this warehouse, however, would not go far. Any who survived the attack tomorrow, he would kill himself. That was his will. Their pagan desert god had nothing to do with it. He would not stretch down a magical hand to protect them and smite their enemies. Allah was a phantom. He was a myth, Basayev thought, a figment from the mind of a disturbed psychopath named Muhammad. The violence and hatred he preached had created over 1,000 years of anguish. Sasha Basayev looked at the men on their mats. How these bloodthirsty animals envisioned any god that would condone their acts of barbarism was beyond him. He would always remember that September day in Beslan. It felt more like spring than the end of summer vacation. His father, the school's director, had awakened him and his younger sister before dawn. His mother, an art teacher, was already cooking breakfast. His father liked to joke that the 2 best days of the year were the first day of school and the last. Sasha liked to respond that his father was only 50% correct. Who in their right mind wanted summer vacation to end? Even their mother, a school teacher, sighed as she moved about the kitchen, pausing as she changed the water in a small vase of flowers they had picked on a recent hike together. The summer had been full of all sorts of adventures. His 6-year-old sister Dasha had ridden her first horse. He and Grigori, his best friend, had found a cave with an abandoned jeep inside. They spent weeks pretending to repair it, discussing all the places it would take them. When Sasha's birthday arrived, his father gave him a beautiful pocket knife. Katya, the neighbor's freckled niece visiting from Stavropol, let him hold her hand. Who would trade any of this for school? The sun was only just beginning to rise when they arrived at their father's office. He poured small coffees for them and allowed them to have extra sugar. It was a reward for getting up so early. Sasha drank his as he watched the officers changing shift at the district police station next door. Many of them had children in the school. Grigori's father was a police officer. He had taken them into the woods over the summer to shoot his pistol. It was very loud. Not as loud, though, as what was to come. The traditional start of the Russian school year was known as First Bell, or Knowledge Day. Children dressed in their best clothes and brought their parents and relatives with them. They presented flowers to the teachers and participated in school-sponsored festivities. Sasha was outside with his parents and sister at 9:11 that morning. They were welcoming everyone when a police van and a military truck pulled up, and his life was shattered forever. Several dozen heavily armed Islamic terrorists leapt out and began shooting. They were dressed in camouflage military fatigues and black masks. Many wore suicide belts. Over 1,000 people were herded and packed into the school's gymnasium. There, the terrorists separated off the biggest, strongest men and executed them. One of them was Sasha's father. During the next 3 days, temperatures in the gymnasium soared. The children stripped down to their underwear. Sasha and his friends drank their own urine from shoes to stay hydrated. His mother was taken away and raped. He never saw her again. The terrorists had rigged the gymnasium with explosive devices in case they were overrun. On the third day, at 1:03 in the afternoon, something exploded. 2 minutes later, there was another explosion. The roof of the gymnasium was on fire. The terrorists refused to let anyone leave. Minutes later, flaming rafters and large sections of roofing began to fall in. Sasha's sister, Dasha, was trapped. He and Grigori tried to get to her, but they couldn't. She burned to death. A third explosion followed, knocking out a huge section of wall. Panicked hostages stampeded to get out. Grigori and Sasha fought their way through the smoke and fire to join them. Then, more shooting started. The terrorists were firing into the crowd, attempting to stop anyone from fleeing alive. Parents, teachers, children, bodies fell all around them. But Sasha and Grigori kept running. They had to get out. They had to get free. There was a pop, and then time collapsed. Sasha looked to his left as half of Grigori's face disappeared. One of the terrorist bullets had tumbled through the back of his head and out the front of his face. He seemed to stare at Sasha as his lifeless body collapsed to the ground. Someone, he would never know who, grabbed Sasha and propelled him forward. People told him he was lucky to be alive, that he must live his life not only for himself, but also for his dead mother, father, and sister. Those people were wrong. There was nothing lucky about his being alive. There was nothing lucky about having lived through what he had. It had broken him, like a watch that had been struck so hard it had stopped at the moment of a terrible accident. He wasn't alive. He was a walking version of death. He was cold through to his very core. Actual, physical death, if it ever came, would be a relief. The CIA team and their women in Anbar was just the beginning, an appetizer. The next attack was going to be even more dramatic.